Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Jacob, what are you drinking?
What I'm drinking tonight is a Spanish coffee. It's a slight variation on the formula, and it contains two kinds of rum, Kahlua, a little bit of Grand Marnier, and a tiny touch of heavy cream poured with the heaviest of hands.
Yeah.
And what do you think of it so far, folks?
Could use more Grand Marnier.
I like coffee a whole bunch, so part of me wishes I had more coffee. Also, because at this point in the drink, it starts to get cold. And then I'm just like, oh, room temperature coffee, which is no one's favorite thing, basically. I'm not. You know, there's a competent shifter of liquids from one vessel to another.
I can shift me some liquids, baby.
There have been many times where I've been sitting at my desk at work with morning coffee in the afternoon because I don't feel like walking across the building to the coffee machine. I drink that room temperature, if not actually cold coffee.
I absolutely do as well, and I regret it as I'm doing it, but I'm not enough to do anything about it. It's that level of discomfort with the world.
Yeah.
I can't stop.
Speaking of having discomfort with the world, you're listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. I'm NPC.
I'm just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
Poppy Beaujolais.
And this time we have a special guest with us in the studio.
Hi, I'm the Mad Marquis.
All right, Marquis, welcome to the show. We've been talking about getting you on here for some time now, specifically to talk about this thing that you do, which is...
I host and produce a bunch of shows where people take off their clothes for the entertainment of random paying strangers.
Jesus Christ, why do we know so many people in that industry?
Hooray. Burlesque.
Oh, that's okay. Oh. Yeah, I've seen a number of your shows. You've been doing this for some time.
The question 9 years,
Oh, wow, nice.
The question is, do we know more or less people who are in the burlesque versus adult?
I think I know more strippers at this point.
Yeah, I think I know more dancers at this point.
Burlesque performers. Yeah.
It depends on how you want me to geographically sort my friends.
And they also know a number.
Well, if we go to that, I know more porn stars. But
that's actually the funny thing is. We'll segue into burlesque and be knowing porn stars later.
Yeah, we're gonna pick your mind and learn a little bit about the history, or at least the history that you've been involved in, much later in the show. But for now, I'm really envious that y'all have drinks and I don't, because I am self-imposed not drinking this month. I wouldn't say sober, because I have a lot of coffee and a lot of weed, but not necessarily booze.
It is alcohol-free January.
Yep. I usually fail at this. I'm giving it another shot.
So for our longtime listeners, you might remember an episode, about, say, 6-8 episodes ago, where I was not drinking on the mics. You might recall a certain co-host ragging on me. This is me proving I'm the better man.
All of us did. And it was funny. And we had a good time.
Sure.
You were into it. Yeah.
So does this make this Walker's water and time wasters for you then?
Oh.
Zing.
So 2019 is upon us. And as always, it's time to look forward to the new year, think about what we want to change in our lives, and more, what do we want to accomplish in the next year? I am going to kick it off with my plans for rides for next year. This coming year, I'm planning on a whole bunch of big trips. I'm going to do a Snake River run up into Washington, over to Seattle, back down, stopping along the way to catch up with friends and family the entire way. I might be going down to a convention, BayCon, in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm planning on doing that by motorcycle. I am planning on at least 4 big motorcycle trips this coming year.
The only thing that I really have planned is... as listeners might know, for the last 6 or 7 months have been biking 28-30 miles a day to and from work. And I feel like, I kind of want to up that.
You know, I'm glad you do that, so I don't have to.
You know, so I was thinking about maybe going and taking a ride out to some place like Forest Grove or McMinnville on bicycle, which I think is around 20-something miles out, because that would be, and if I do that back and forth in a day, you're getting close to 50.
In a suit.
Oh, of course. Well, how else do you bike?
What am I, a farmer?
Some of us sweat and don't like biking in our suits because we don't want to pay for dry cleaning every time we get on a bike.
Yeah. Some of us sweat and don't give a shit.
Well, that's
why
Tom
did you make me sit next to him in
out.
His suit?
How you doing? Yeah, so that I was planning on doing something like that, you know, just to kind of get the old legs moving and eventually, possibly consider moving up to something like STP.
Stunted Pilot?
Yes.
Okay.
No, Seattle to Portland.
Oh, okay.
That's that big yearly ride where you ride from Seattle to Portland in 2 days on a bicycle.
Oh, yeah. We talked about that. Yeah.
Unless you're my cousin, in which case you do it in one day.
Some people do it in a day, which is nuts.
Wow. No. That, I could probably do it in 10.
It's actually not that bad a pace given the terrain.
Yeah.
Like I used to bike about 20 miles to work round trip every day. And the 20 miles is super casual biking once you've spent like a month on a bike.
Yeah.
As it turns out, like it sounds like a lot when you don't bike at all, but it only takes like a month of like biking every day or every other day. And then you're like 20 miles, whatever. I didn't even notice that I did 20 miles today.
Yeah. And I can attest to that too. And then as I get ready to do something like STP, maybe in a year or two, you know, I'm going to have to go and make it so I bike out to Hood River in one go, which is about 70 miles, I want to say, from here.
It's not quite that far. It's like 50.
It depends where in Portland you start.
Ish.
Like it's an hour in the car, so at 55 miles an hour in theory. The Google says it's an hour, but it's not really an hour if you speed like everybody does.
Yeah. Well, I know that whenever people online are talking about heading out to one of my favorite conventions, which we were at, WagonCon, it's out in the Dalles, Oregon. If you look at Google, Google says, oh, it's like an hour. It's like 2 hours.
No, it's like an hour 15.
We make it in an hour, usually.
Google thinks you obey all traffic laws and literally never speed.
Yeah. You know, it's about an hour and 15 unless you have to stop for Doritos. Not that we've ever stopped for Doritos.
Oh, shit. I forgot all about that.
A night train.
Yeah.
Nope.
Whoa.
No one stopped for Doritos. There was no stopping for Doritos.
There was also no stopping for night train because we had a bunch of really fancy Irish whiskey awaiting us and we didn't want to fuck up our palates.
But
you didn't
need
Doritos and then immediately slammed expensive Irish whiskey.
Oh, okay. There were no Doritos. Of course. My apologies.
The real question is if you pour the whiskey into like a bugle and then eat the bugle, is that classy?
Oh my God.
I mean, technically, we have a drinking horn.
I think we have a drink for a future episode is whiskey and bugles.
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be something like Beam 8 Star. Or was that Beam 5 Star? 8 Star? God, stuff's awful.
We need to invite Buckley for that one.
It might be better with something like vodka that craves salty, right?
Yeah,
like to be like serious about it for a second, like thinking about it. It's like, you don't normally.
Buckley makes it serious.
Well, you know, I'm like, I prefer, like, speaking for myself, I really like food. I'm like a wannabe gourmand at home, right? Like,
sure.
And so, like, you give me some dumb ingredients, and it only takes me a second to be like, wait, how would I try and make that work?
If I'm going to drink hard liquor from a bugle.
And I'm, well, like vodka or a tequila or something that craves the salty a little more than whiskey, right?
Mm.
Like whiskey, you don't normally pair with salty things. You pair it with citrus maybe, but not like the saltiness. But like salty and crunchy, like that's like vodka maybe. And then, of course, it's what flavor bugles do you use?
Jesus Christ.
Y'all are just a bunch of heathens because the only thing that goes inside of a bugle is fucking easy cheese.
Wrong. There's one other acceptable option, which is, of course, your fingertips for witch fingers.
Of course. That's true. Yes.
Pimentos.
Pimento bugles.
What is happening right now?
You get a jar of pimentos and put the pimentos in the bugle.
I can't believe I've never done peanut butter inside of a bugle.
Actually, I'm thinking blue cheese would be really like the classy, like oddly like sexy option. But I love blue cheese in like basically everything.
Goat cheese.
Well, okay. Goat cheese
inside of a bugle. And then we're going to drink like a nice dry Riesling with
nacho, the nacho bugles with pub cheese, but the horseradish.
Okay.
That'd be pretty solid.
With a Sangiovese.
So what we're saying is that any kind of diets you might have pledge for 2019 are hereby dead on arrival. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, listener.
Bugles and diets are
your
not
New Year's that. Resolution has just ended.
You are listening to Bugles, Dice, and Whiskey. I'm Poppy Beaujolais.
And Bugles Company, please whoever makes
the,
you.
Please send the
sponsor a podcast.
Please send the podcast vines of you eating Bugles stuffed with random things as well.
Yes, please do that.
So, Poppy, ooh, yeah. Now I believe yes, you sir. Are committed to, on record this year, getting up to being able to bike 50 miles in one go.
No.
What do you got on the deck? No.
So, okay, no, my current pipe dreams are figure out how to ride a bicycle more than a mile without being in extreme pain.
Recumbent.
I have, with my current bicycle, without spending a lot more money, basically. Oh, okay. Ooh.
Yeah. Let me hook you up with a friend who can do a bike fitting.
Yeah, I need to do a bike fitting. I need to get a different seat. I need to get padded bike shorts. I have what they call a very sensitive sit bone. So even riding on a bicycle for 20, 30 minutes, I'm in pain for 2 or 3 days in my nethers. It's not pleasant. And if you, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know what this is like, imagine somebody hitting you repeatedly in the crotch with a 2x4.
I love that show.
For a few hours. And anyway.
Well, and it's funny because as a bike person too, like women put more thought into their comfort on a bike, but guys suffer far more lasting injuries from it. Like sterility from biking is a super legit thing, and like permanent impotence if you're on the wrong bike seat. So it's like the damage is very real to people of any gender. And particularly, I mean, there's a reason why you're supposed to have a divot under your perineum in your fucking bike seat, because otherwise you will cripple yourself.
Oh, yeah. I had to get a special seat. You know,
I mean, it feels as close to having a bone bruise as I can imagine.
Sucks.
Like, it's really uncomfortable.
Because you have a bone bruise.
So I have a fucking bone bruise on my
tailbone.
On my sit bone. I've heard it referred to as my sit bone. Anyway.
You're a chode.
The people who have the full...
Don't call her that.
Even the non-recumbent bikes where you see people who've attached like a full seat, right, rather than a bike saddle, is, I'm like, that's legit for comfort. Like, if you're going to be biking 50 miles or...
Yeah.
I had a buddy who was turning 45 a couple of years ago. He lives in New York now, but he's a tech nerd from the Bay originally, and he screwed off from his job. Are we allowed to swear? Can I just say fucked off from his job?
Fucking whatever you want, man.
So he's a program developer, right? And he fucked off from his job, stopped by Portland to hang out at strip clubs, flew to Vancouver, British Columbia, bought a bike, and then biked to Tijuana.
Holy shit.
Man after my own heart.
With no time frame. Like, just, I'm going to ride a bike to Tijuana because I'm 45 and I need to prove I can do awesome shit still, kind of thing.
That's fucking fantastic.
I have an acquaintance who did the same thing, except it was Vancouver to the tip of the Baja Peninsula, and it was a motorcycle.
Yeah, I don't think he did Baja. I think he just biked to Tijuana. And he, you know, he was only doing 10, 20, 30 miles a day. He wasn't trying to set any sort of pace record or anything.
So much to me.
But, you know, he lost 45 pounds in the 2 months it took him, and moved to New York ready to like slay all the ladies and have a good time. So
see, and that's what I'm talking about. Like, I want to slay me some ladies in New York. No, I'm just kidding. My new job that I got back in September is now only maximum 4 miles from my house. I'm not commuting to fucking, you know, Gladstone every day.
So a hyper-casual bike ride once you can do the bike ride.
Exactly. Yeah. It'd be fantastic when the weather is nice, because let's face it, I'm going to be a fair weather cyclist. If I could
appreciate the honesty.
If it's raining, I'm taking my cage. but if on a nice day during the spring and summer, if I could ride to work, it would be fucking fantastic.
On the topic of being a fair weather cycler, so when I first started bike commuting to work, I lived 30 yards from a transit stop for a train that stopped in front of my office building at the time.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, I'm totally going to never ride in the rain because the max is right here and I'm just going to do that. But after one summer of just biking every day, you couldn't have paid me to get on the train.
That's fair.
No matter how bad the weather got, I biked in. And it took only 3 months to be much happier on a bike than dealing with public transit.
That's totally fair.
Or driving, to just entirely be done with caring about the weather.
Yeah. Well, and my other pipe dream, of course, is to get a 125cc or less scooter. And
same.
I've noticed that I have more or less organized my life now that I stay between like 82nd and Fremont, like 30th and Hawthorne, and like 20th and Burnside. Like, I stay in this sort of square.
And now we've triangulated your address.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I stay basically in Northeast and Southeast below 82nd and above 20th. And I don't really need a car for all the things I need to go do.
Yeah.
And again, I'm going to be a fair weather scooterer as well. But I love to get a scooter and just have that as my little tooling around vehicle instead of my Nissan.
Bringing it back to what you were just saying a moment ago, Mark, one of my plans for this year, and I failed at it last year, is getting to that state where I've done it for 3 straight months and nothing but, and I want to get back to that state that I used to have a decade ago, where my bicycle was my primary mode, where I was just, there was no question. I got out, I got on the bike. I didn't even put it on the bus. I just went everywhere on that ancient, heavy-ass Schwinn. But I was so freaking strong because of it. And I was like in great shape.
What was the reaction you had the moment you got a better bike, though?
I don't have a better bike. Oh. That is my bike still.
No, you have like 3 bicycles out there.
I have 2 bicycles out there.
Okay.
I remember.
The other one I have is like a little city. It's like a little town beater. Not even a beater. We call it. It's like a neighborhood cruiser, but not a cruiser. Poppy and I have matching bikes.
That's really cool.
They're little Civias that we got from Tippy TF Bikes.
Hey, editor, cut in a picture of the bike there for like the people to look at as the link for this podcast.
I might do that.
Them and their bikes and their matching bikes. Hopefully also matching gang outfits like you're from the Warriors.
But I do have my battle jacket now.
But I am also, I've been thinking about this for the last week, considering getting an electric assist bike.
Those are pretty sweet. Donut.
I saw someone kicking around one of those the other day, and it actually looked pretty awesome.
Every person I've talked to who got one loved it intensely. I honestly think that on the east side of Portland, it's barely necessary. Like, you know, sure, Mount Tabor blows when you're just starting to like ride or whatever, but it takes so little time to get used to just biking uphill at your own pace and being comfortable and you're making progress and whatever.
Decide whether you want a electric assist bike or a bike that can do all of the power for you before you buy it. Know where your heart lies and buy that thing.
That's totally fair.
Because I know so many people who went, I want an electric bike so when I'm going up steep hills or so I can push myself and go into the West Hills and so I have all that power. And then they realize that they can whip along at 28 miles an hour or more on electric assist, not doing a goddamn thing with their feet. And then they basically have a bicycle that might as well be an electric motorcycle.
That's what I want is just for the hills. So get
one of the ones that's designed to be an electric assist only, where it takes up the load for you, and not one that does the power stroke for you.
Yeah, I was considering looking at the electric assist or, you know, little baby scooters, basically, bicycles because of my knee issues. So it's not only an again, part of the pain is my sit bone, but the other part is my 20-plus-year-old patella femoral pain syndrome that I've got, where for the folks at home, that means my kneecaps don't like to stay where they're supposed to be.
Y'all need mopeds.
So the idea of when my knees start to hurt, you know, and I'm working with a personal trainer to kind of get all that shit figured out, but like, being able to turn that on and have a little extra help and still be able to have the pleasure of bicycling sounds pretty great.
Moving on to other plans for 2019. Well, we're all nerds. I assume we all got some gaming plans going on. Xander, what are you looking forward to playing this year?
I am very much looking forward to playing this game that I just found out about, ironically, through an Instagram ad. Boy, do they have my number on this one. It's called Iron Harvest. Okay, there's a high five from Jacob. Yeah, yeah. Iron Harvest is set in a alternative reality post-World War I, where the fields of Europe are just lined with discarded iron. The European forces are gearing up towards war again, but this time, because I'm a sucker for this, they have built giant mechanized units.
It's not a mobile game, is it? Because that's to be what you find on advertisements.
No, it is PC RTS.
Fascinating.
PC RTS with accompanying miniatures game.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. So you basically have the quote-unquote Russian side, the quote-unquote Polish side, and the quote-unquote German side.
All hail the Poles.
Yeah. So Iron Harvest was a Kickstarter thing. They raised over $1 million when they just had nothing but plans. They also went and sent surveys out to 15,000 RTS players and said, what would you like in a classic RTS style
game? That sounds
game?
Like a terrible idea.
That sounds like a terrible thing to do. It never, looked- ever. Designed by like
committee.
It's
not
especially
by committee
of players. Other players know.
Well, if you're asking me, it's abstract. You might learn something interesting.
Yeah,
that's
yeah. It's not solely based on that. They took their ideas and then kind of went with because they're all classic RTS players in this as well. But
okay.
But the mechs look fucking cool. The artwork that I've seen so far is absolutely gorgeous. The scenery just looks outstanding. They have, I think. For one of the first RTSs too that has kind of fully deployable barriers you can build and cover, and also fully destroyable cover. So in that regard, it's kind of like modern FPSs in which you can just destroy everything, but it, you can also rebuild it too, and it looks really fucking cool. I recommend you check out the trailers.
Yeah, we'll check it out, and I'll put some links in the notes.
Yeah.
Marquee, what are you looking forward to playing?
Let's see. On the video game side, if Borderlands 3 comes out, I'm sure I will be immersed in that for some period of time. On the tabletop miniature game side, I am like chronically underserved in the tabletop arena right now. There is a chronic conversation with my current housemates about starting like a, some sort of tabletop role-playing game. Odds are it'd end up being something like, I don't know, some the new version of Fate or something really system-like because I'm just lazy about doing math when I role-play. a buddy of mine who's actually the partner of a burlesque performer I work with a lot, he's a huge miniature wargaming nerd, and he's been trying to get me into this game called Gaslands,
okay,
which I am not personally familiar with, but the way he describes it, it sounds like somebody did a house rules version of the old Games Workshop game Dark Future from like 1991, where you can just make your own wargaming miniatures out of like toy guns and like Hot Wheels cars.
You know, it sounds like every few years, a number of these really fascinating, beautifully sculpted, very neat games pop up on the miniatures and then fail.
Well, like, that's certainly true. Yeah. Gaslands, to my understanding, is just like a free game. I haven't played it at all. Let me throw that out for any listeners who know more about this game than I do. I've just had it described to me extensively by a friend, and it's apparently intended to be played with homemade miniatures. There is no business as that's far as cool. I think I gave away the rules on the internet, and it's just become popular anyway. The whole flash in the pan miniature design thing, I think that's. If I were to theorize as to why that's the case, I'd bet it's because so many people are graduating with basic 3D modeling skills from various schools these days, and it's not as expensive to crank out resin miniatures via 3D prototyping anymore. I mean, that's probably the answer.
If I were into minis, the miniature collecting wargaming hobby, then the first thing that I would do as a nerd today is acquire a builder kit and then never buy minis ever again.
The 3D printing, I don't think, is quite there for, you know, at the quality level of the high-end miniature, you know, like Games Workshop or whoever who's got 30 years of expertise or whatever in their miniature making. But it's getting there. And I think there's definitely going to be a sea change in the miniature world sometime in the next 10 or 20 years, and God only knows when.
Jacob, what about you? What's on the docket?
So for coming year, my big focus is I have three different games I need to get off the ground. I am trying to complete this year a promise I made some friends last year, and later this month, probably, possibly top of February, I'm starting up a role-playing game of The Witcher, tabletop role-playing game, for a group of friends. In addition, I have a series of Delta Green games I'm going to be running over the course of this year that are in short format, but a series of short campaigns connected to an overarching group with different groups of players, all each of which will be informing the greater storyline.
It's difficult.
It's difficult. I've done it before. And then the last is I backed a number of Kickstarters last year. One of them I'm very excited about. I am not going to attempt to pronounce the name of it. I'll put it in the links. But it is a African diaspora science fiction role-playing game.
Ooh.
The rule set is just, I'm impressed by what I've seen so far. and the lore that's behind it looks really solid. I'm looking forward to doing testing that and hopefully demoing it. And then as a number four, it's a number four, but that's because they have a late delivery date. There is a game that has been put out, which is a high fantasy Mexican mythology. And when I say Mexican mythology, I'm not talking any one particular group that makes up Mexican culture, but an agglomeration of everything from Aztec to Mayan.
Kind of a Central America thing.
But even with some, European influence in there, but it's definitely got a feel. It's high. It's a high mythic. It's not supposed to drop until the end of August because it's a Kickstarter. We'll see if it even makes 2019. but if it drops, I'm also looking forward to running that one.
You remember the name of it?
That one, I do not remember the name of. It's been a bad year for Kickstarters and I.
Man, I have so many Kickstarters that are just now starting to deliver. And I'll talk about them in a second. But Poppy,
yes.
What is your gaming in 2019 looking like?
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to some more Hammer Crawl. We'll be talking about that later. I'm very much enjoying being on the Hammer Crawl podcast for Wolves of Zeramond. But I am looking forward to wrapping that one up and maybe moving on to some new storylines, new characters. And we're going to do some other, one-shots later this year. But again, more on that later. And I am really looking forward to playing more Overcooked 2 on the various consoles we have back here. We played that we've been playing Overcooked for not quite a year now. And Overcooked 2 came out recently. And we were playing that on Christmas with a buddy of ours. And it's just a wonderful game.
I apparently am woefully behind the times. What is this Overcooked you speak of?
Okay, so we affectionately refer to it as the cooking game. And it is a cooperative multiplayer, obviously, cooking kitchen simulator.
It's a multiplayer cooperative kitchen simulator during the apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
That you were really burying the lead there. That was,
the lead. I always kind of forget
Poppy
about
Poppy may frequently bury the lead.
I don't know what you're talking about. I just bury bodies, baby. Anyway, cut that. Anyway, I always forget about the during the apocalypse thing because it's always just a ridiculous kitchen kind of nightmare scenario, and it's hilarious and it's very stressful.
It's but really doesn't fun. Have to be.
It's really stressful.
So, as somebody who likes to cook in their personal life, like I always find people trying to help me often stressful. Like it's often easier to just do things yourself and take slightly longer when you're cooking at home than to get
Come on, let me chop the onions for you. Come on.
And that's the thing with this game is you have to help each other. And a lot of times it's set up in such a way that you can't do everything yourself.
Fair.
There is a dividing line between you and your ingredients.
I mean, I had to ask for help while cooking dinner last night, so I understand. It happens from time to time.
It's all good. Yeah. We can, if we have time, if we don't go too late, we can maybe very briefly show you cooking game.
Cooking salmon filet mignon and roasting vegetables, and somebody had to toss the goddamn salad, okay?
Did you rue the day that had to happen?
Yes, Rue did make that day happen.
Fortunately,
who tossed your salad for you?
My partner, Rue, hence the bad pun from
Thank you.
Okay.
Fortunately, in Overcooked and Overcooked 2, you can throw things on the floor and pick them up, and you don't lose points for it.
That just means this game was programmed by people who cook.
There's no health department in this game. It's totally fine.
There's no health department in your kitchen either.
That's fair.
No, I have frequently said what drives me crazy at work, where I work in the service industry, and those rules go right out the fucking door when I'm at home cooking.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably fine.
And to be fair, like your kitchen has the amount of traffic of your household in it, not 50 people. And it's very different.
Yeah. Yeah. But the things I'm okay with in the kitchen at home and what I'm okay with at work are vastly different.
I'm also looking forward to playing more Overcooked on a computer game level. I have so many games from so many Steam sales.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a number
of... I blame you for my Steam habit.
I've gotten a number of RPG Maker games recently that I'm trying to cut my way through. I've been in kind of a classic JRPG style. The Legend of Heroes series is an ongoing saga that is slowly being ported to PC from the PlayStation. And they are just amazingly deep JRPGs. But specifically, these games have more lines of dialogue in them than there are text in the George R. R. Martin series. There's just so much depth of character, and they never go where you think they're going to go, and they're also really fun. And I really need to finish that saga. I am now 5 games behind.
Yikes. I mean, speaking of being behind games, I really should play Red Dead Redemption 2, but I want to mention that my original copy of Red Dead Redemption is presumably still somewhere in the shelf of Nathaniel's.
Oh, it is. Next to some Robotech and
I
other stuff.
I loaned it to him unopened about 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And I just want to taunt him about that on mic.
So other things that I want to do, I'm planning on playing some more Warframe. I got into it and then I hit like a plateau that I just haven't been able to overcome. So I took a break. I think I'm going to get back into it.
Is Warframe only competitive multiplayer? Or is
it's only cooperative.
Cooperative mode.
There is a competitive mode, but nobody plays it because it's terrible.
Like I played like 10 seconds of it at a PAX or something, and that's all I remember about Warframe.
10 seconds is not enough to understand how to play that game.
I exaggerate, but you know, like one session at PAX one year, and that's all I remember about it.
And another game that I'm looking forward to getting more is that Poppy and I have been playing cooperative Lego Jurassic World. And
what?
It's the first time I've ever actually sat down and immersed myself in a Lego game. It is surprisingly a shitload of fun. When you unlock the Velociraptor that gets to ride the motorcycle, you're like, okay, this is what gaming was made for.
What?
You can run around as Triceratops and stomp people. Yeah.
You are not allowed to tell my sweetie about this game.
I mean, the Lego games are very destructive, and they're satisfying in that, like, you're walking in the snow and you see an unintended snowman kind of way. Like, that is the appeal of the Lego video games, as far as I can tell.
I like my relationship. I like having my relationship. I like seeing my sweetie. You are not allowed to tell her this exists.
That's just too bad, because I'm gonna message them right now. And we're how many players can we have on this game? And
only 2.
Son of a bitch. Yep.
I would argue the Lego games are only fun co-op. So as long as you play with them, it should be fine.
It's not fun playing.
Like, they're super boring by themselves. Me and my partner played through basically all of the Star Wars one that was like all of the movies. Like all 6 Star Wars.
But that
movies
just means
time.
Amanda's gonna be over at Cassie's and I'm never gonna see either of them.
That's your logistical problem, I guess.
Bringing it to the tabletop, there, I want to finish my Stars Without Number game, at least give it a few more sessions and bring it to an actual suitable conclusion at some point. Because the problem with long-term sandbox campaigns is they tend to fizzle out eventually. I don't want this to happen. I want the characters to reach a suitable narrative.
You were
conclusion.
Scaring me here because I feel like we're just catching steam and suddenly you're talking about
no.
End.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Like, dude, no.
Well, I'm thinking about this as I am preparing for the next chapter, and I'm remembering that this is something that I want to eventually bring to a suitable conclusion. So I'm already thinking at that point. It's definitely something that I don't want to, as we said in the last episode, I don't want to get distracted by a new shiny, of which I have several that I'm not even going to go into right now, thanks to Kickstarters finally delivering.
Do you find it hard to, in a sandbox style RPG, and maybe you've talked about this before, but like it's always tricky in a non-narrative driven RPG as the game master, right, to sort of bring every character's plots to sort of a valid conclusion, right? Whereas if there's an overarching plot, you know, throw the ring in Mount Doom, then you're done, whatever, right? Like without that, I find the challenge for me would be trying to plan the timing right of like tying up the characters' stories in a similar time frame. Like, you know, because some person's plot lines might be relatively far progressed. Other people's might be a little more spread out still. And like getting the timing right of having them all sort of come to a climax in the same zone seems very difficult.
We could talk about that for a significantly longer period of time, but we do touch on it in our last episode, which you should listen to.
I'm bad at podcasts.
Now, Xander, I understand you want to talk about a game that we probably won't be playing, or maybe you already have been playing.
I've been playing it.
You have?
He's been playing it. Oh my God, has he been playing it?
Really?
I've just been following your Facebook feed and all your photos.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, just today I made a new album on the Facebooks of my postcards from West Virginia.
So how terrible is it?
It made me love Fallout 4 way more than I did before.
And we're speaking of?
Fallout 76.
Yeah.
I haven't played it at all. One of my housemates played it right when he got it and then got really bored because he's not into multiplayer. Like, he's one of those guys.
So I think a lot of people bought it thinking it was going to be a Fallout game. but it's not a Fallout game.
Okay, so I have a lot of thoughts on this. I've been playing it since beta because I pre-ordered it like an idiot. And
I don't think anybody would have assumed that was a bad choice prior to the now.
I mean, even though I kind of knew what it was going to be, I still thought it's going to be West Virginia. The entire...
West Virginia.
I know. I can't. Yeah. I keep Mount wanting Mama. To do that too.
Take me home? No.
Country road.
And now I'm just thinking of Mark Strong in the second Kingsman movie, but that's, you know.
So the entire setting is beautiful. The soundtrack and the songs they put in there, the new ones, the new old songs they put in there are great. For those who don't know, the basic premise is that you're in Vault 76, the Tricentennial Vault, and you emerge, I think, 20 years later on Reclamation Day to a very, very, very abandoned America. The only things that I can say are good about the game is that the new mutated creatures are all based on West Virginia folklore, which is tits.
So it's all based on tits?
Yes. No. Okay.
Then I might play this game.
You know, so you know.
I remember that episode of South Park.
So the Mothman is in there, Snollygasters, really frightening looking three-headed possum.
Yikes.
So before we go too deeply into this, I have a feeling that we could probably talk about this game and all the story behind it and all the controversy around it more fully on another segment.
Sure.
Because I think this game, I think I feel that it deserves it.
I think it does as well. Yeah. So I will just say I'm curious to see what they do with this game in the new year, which probably should not have been released until this year.
So stay tuned, folks.
They should have delayed it a few months. But anyways, I'm curious to see what they do with it and if they actually fix it to make it more like an actual Fallout game as opposed to the clusterfuck that they have delivered.
I will just say that I have learned how many of my acquaintances are actually computer gamers strictly by people I never knew played computer games bitching about Fallout 76.
Ooh, I thought of one other computer game I do want to play that I forgot to mention. Deep Rock Galactic is super fun and I can't wait for that to officially launch.
I heard about it. That sounded like a good one.
So fucking. Yeah. You're angry dwarves mining asteroids and fighting bugs. It's Minecraft / Left 4 Dead in space. It's the best thing ever as far as I'm concerned. / Dwarf Fortress, I guess.
I'm sold.
Did you say fighting bugs or pugs?
Whichever.
Oh, okay.
It's bugs, but pugs would be an awesome skin like overlay.
Dwarves space versus pugs. Space pugs?
I'm so into that. Although now I'm visualizing the aliens from Mom and Dad Save the Universe, whatever that terrible John Lovitz movie is, because there was the fish people and the dog people in that movie.
No idea.
Mom and Dad Save the
Universe. That sounds like a fever dream.
It was one of the worst movies ever made. Like you, the fact that you don't remember it means you're a better person than me.
Worse than cat people?
Oh, vastly.
Wow.
Either cat people.
And let's talk about some drinks that we're looking forward to having on the podcast or just personally throughout the coming year. I know that, Xander, you mentioned you had acquired something special.
Sure did. So for Christmas this year, my girlfriend traveled across state lines to go and find me a fifth of Yellow Spot.
Ooh,
just some good old.
Now, if anybody does not aware, Yellow Spot is a whiskey that we were introduced to on the Irish Whiskey Special.
Thank you, Matt.
Visit our buddy Matt Buckley, and he took us on a taster through 5 different Irish whiskeys, several of which were quite rare and expensive.
So, anyways, she had gone and listened to that episode, and better remembered than I did, because I think that was about 4 or 5 whiskeys in, that was
of the 7 that you and I had.
Yeah, that was probably the favorite one that I had that time. And so when she wrapped the gift, I looked at it and I thought, that's clearly a fifth of liquor. I've already told her that my favorite scotch is Lagavulin 16, and I already have that in the house, so I don't know what this could possibly be.
Our good friend Chris, who we've referenced a number of times in the past on this show, as a wedding gift, got me and Poppy a bottle, after listening to that show and talking to us, a bottle of Redbreast's 12 cask strength.
Yeah.
And we're saving it for a special occasion.
It is currently hidden somewhere.
Yeah. You just hide it from yourself and hope to find it in a few years, because that makes sense.
They give it to the cat.
Isn't it what the glove box in the car is for? Every time I put something in there, I just find it like 4 months later.
For me, that's my pocket. Sometimes I find cookies in there.
That's why
I forgot I put that.
I do laundry. I found $50 when I did laundry yesterday.
Oh, what?
Yeah. I mean, it was my $50, but
it's like free money at that point, because you've already forgotten it and written it off.
Pro drinker tip, do not store alcohol in your glove compartment in any climate where you spend a lot of time with the heater core on.
Yeah. So anyways, I just opened up this Christmas gift and it was a fifth of yellow spot, which I didn't even know you could get here.
So
wait, you can't. That was,
well, I don't know how she found it. She found it in Washington.
Why do they call it yellow spot? What's the name mean aside from the obvious gross association?
I know this. You see, there's a yellow spot on it.
We did actually learn this from our friend Matt in the Dalles.
Am I allowed to throw things during this podcast? Yes.
No, you are not allowed to throw things.
No, I said yes, that was wrong. I retract
soft
that.
Things. You can throw soft
There's
things.
There's a bowl of dice in front of me. There's very conveniently throwable objects.
We've had this discussion before. No throwing things. It escalates too fast.
Fair.
So I guess the distillery back in the 1800s used to just mark their whiskeys with a green spot or a yellow spot to distinguish what whiskeys that they were. And so when they revamped this whiskey, that's what they did in honor of how they used to do things.
Cool.
They called it, they have the green spot, and then they have a yellow spot.
And which is the better one?
Yellow.
What's the difference, I guess, is probably a better question.
That's a whole other episode.
You actually should go back and listen to our Average Whiskey Special.
Wishing you guys be drunk having this explained to you because you guys don't remember.
No, you should go back and listen to it. It's a great episode. Thanks again, Matt, for introducing us to awesome whiskey.
It's floral, it's everything, and it's smooth, at least 12 years, and it is exceptional, so I am looking forward to not drinking that whole bottle this year.
I am definitely looking forward to you bringing that onto the show and us talking about it some more.
I would say... Yeah.
Or you bring it over and them drinking the whole bottle.
No.
Portion it out.
Pour like 4 shots of it and just bring that.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to bring the whole bottle.
Don't bring the whole bottle.
I'm just going to put it in a small container and I'm just going to be like, this is all that we have.
Yep.
Everything else stays at home.
I'm
locking it up.
Nathaniel and I got some like travel flasks from my parents for Christmas. So we do have 2 perfect little travel flasks.
Yeah, we could totally hook you. We could make this happen. Anyway, what else we got? Any other things that we're planning on bringing on? I think somebody had mentioned a spy themed episode.
Oh, yes.
Ooh.
Vespers?
Vespers.
Yeah.
What is it?
So a Vesper. So.
Oh, the short version.
The short version. A Vesper is the traditional drink in the James Bond novels, as opposed to the martini.
Thank you.
A classic drink.
Thank you.
I, as a huge drink and James Bond nerd, am ready to chime in with the long version of the story, which I'm not going to do.
We'll have you on when we do that episode.
Excellent. Yes. I will just point out that the Vesper is the drink that proves to you that Ian Fleming was the least repentant alcoholic to ever walk the damn planet. Because he sat and looked at a martini, because he invented the Vesper and wrote it into Casino Royale. And he invented it because he was like, there's not enough booze in this gin. I mean, that was his thought when assembling the drink. He's like, nope, I need a better one. But I'm gonna paraphrase the quote from Casino Royale that I think sums up the Vesper accurately. Lighter hears Bond order it and says, that's a hell of a drink. Bond looks at him because he's Bond. And he says, when I drink before dinner, which I don't always, I like that drink to be very strong, very good, very large, and very well made. And I'm paraphrasing. The quote's a little different than that. But yeah, just remember, Ian Fleming fought in the war, had PTSD, drank a lot.
God bless you.
Yeah.
And was not a part of the Cambridge Five.
One drink that I'd like to bring on the show coming up soon was, again, another gift. This one for my birthday, which was last month. My best man from a wedding followed up and gave me something called Yazzie Ginger Flavored Vodka.
Oh, yeah.
It's in a very fancy
glass. Oh, yeah.
That is a beautiful bottle.
With a dragon on the glass.
And, do you know who makes that?
What?
You know who makes that?
I have no idea who makes that.
HRD, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Hood River Distillery.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Really?
Hood River Distillery. Anyway, it's ginger flavored vodka, but he wants me to mix it with his buttermilk number 5.
Bittermilk.
Buttermilk. Handcrafted cocktail mix or charred grapefruit tonic with Bull's Bay sea salt.
Remember to remind me of this later, and I will send you the recipe for the Curry Thunder, which is based off Yazzie.
Okay, sounds great.
This bottle is also like vastly heavy. You could forever.
You could beat Home Intruder with that bottle.
Yeah, sure could.
You basically hold up your Dungeon Crawl Classics book as a shield, and then you beat them with a Yazzie bottle. Oh my God, we got to make this happen.
That's a photo shoot that's going to happen. Yeah.
So in June of this year, I would like to go and bring on my favorite cocktail, which is the Widow's Kiss.
Oh.
High five from Jacob again.
Tell me more.
Two in an episode. That's great.
Can we pair that with a trident?
I'm familiar with the trident, but...
So, for those of us who employ bartenders, rather than knowing how to make drinks, what's in a widow's kiss?
That's good.
I'm sorry. Do we have management among us, Stas?
I order drinks. That's what I meant by employ bartenders. I go to bars and say, you there, expert, make me a drink.
So the widow's kiss, the primary spirit is Calvados, which is a French apple brandy from the Calvados region of Normandy, France. It is Dom Benedictine, which is made by French monks, and it is traditionally yellow chartreuse, though I prefer green chartreuse in it because green chartreuse is less sweet, which is also made by French monks. It is a very herby cocktail. It's made with Angostura bitters as well. It is stirred. It is served up, usually with a fancy cherry. And I am going to be bringing this because of my grandfather's story from his time in Normandy during World War II, in which he was given...
You should share it at the episode
I will.
To keep people waiting.
Yeah, yeah. I'll share that. But I'll share why I'm bringing it.
Yeah.
I'll share that episode. There's your teaser.
Any other fancy drinks you got planned?
Well, I'm saying that you guys should bring me back to drink the stuff that I'm named after. So my real name is Mark, as you may have surmised, but I'm named after a type of French brandy because my dad is a drinker. And it's called Mark, and it's brandy made from the crushed grape leavings, not the fresh grape. So like you make wine and then you're like, what do we do with this crap? And you distill it and you make Mark. So I am the crap made from the leftover wine, as it turns out.
That's a good story.
But it's not grappa. It's brandy.
Yes. It's
a brandy.
It's a brandy. I don't know if calling it just brandy is doing it the correct description. It's made from both the grapes and the stems and the whole thing.
Oh, right?
All of that gets thrown and distilled and made into a stuff. I've had it only once when my dad bought it for me about 20 years ago. And I honestly just don't remember at this point what I thought of it at the time.
Just blacked out.
I'm just old and have forgotten.
Okay.
Because you drink.
So Poppy has a wine club.
I do.
And I understand one of the next drinks is
Madeira. Yeah. Sexy. My February wine club. So this year we're doing something a little bit different with my wine club, which is called In Praise of Bacchus. Yes, thank you very much. And I'm doing it every other month instead of every month, just to schedule is hard.
Being an adult is hard.
Working full time, being on three podcasts and all the other things that got
hobbies
going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so doing the wine club every other month, and February is going to be a Madeira tasting. And somewhere in the spring, we're going to have Matt Buckley up here to Portland. He's going to do a wine whiskey tasting for my wine club.
Oh, nice.
At some point. What? And Just Jacob will be cooking for us that
day. Can I join your wine club for a month?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
I like this wine that you made from barley.
Whiskey. And other than that, everything is kind of to be determined.
Anyway, closing out this little portion of the discussion, I am on the lookout for any kind of wines, drinks, beverages that are bicycle, bike, or nerd themed. So, dear listeners, if you have ideas, please send them to us and we'll add them to the roster. So anyway, we've got some events coming up. Jacob, tell us more about them.
Well, in this coming year, it's going to be hopefully the start of a breakout year for the Breakfast Puppies productions overall. So starting on March 30th at GameStorm 21 here in Portland, Oregon, we're going to be doing a live recording of Hammer Crawl.
Woo!
That's another one of our podcasts. We have this podcast that's been kind of going on for a little bit since last year. I've been recording it for a long time, but it's very exciting.
And then later this year, we're going to be out again, going back to the Dalles for a live recording of at least Hammer Crawl, possibly more, at WagonCon.
WagonCon!
100% more wagons!
Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to it.
How many wagons were there before?
One.
Two.
So four wagons?
Well, I think in their first year, they had 100 people. And then I think...
I don't care about the people. You said wagon con. I want to know how many wagons are there.
I was promised
some wagons.
So the first year they didn't have any wagons.
Boo.
And then the next year they had one wagon. So I think that was
That's an infinite increase.
And that will be at Wagon Con, which is going to be the 3rd, 4th, 5th of May 2019.
Oh yeah, got to put those days off so I can join you guys this time.
Yeah.
Yes, you should. Oh,
gosh, you got to come out. It's so good.
We're going to miss May the 4th again.
Yeah, well, you know what? That's
it's okay. It's a fake anniversary anyway.
It's okay.
No.
So we celebrate Disney holidays.
We celebrated the 40th anniversary of Star Wars, and it's not May 4th. Everybody thinks it is just because of the dumb pun. And it's
we celebrate is the pun.
Yeah,
that's,
which is fine. Yeah. Just don't pretend it's the anniversary.
Anyway, we can
cut that.
Who
calls it an anniversary?
That's not an anniversary?
Every dumb motherfucker on the internet.
Well, they're dumb.
Idiots do that.
Like I said,
idiot.
The internet.
Yeah.
And the last is we are going to be at Oricon 41 here in Portland with all three shows at Oricon 41.
Nice.
Nice.
Is that the 41st year?
41st year.
Holy crap.
Get the fuck out.
Yeah. What?
It's Oregon's oldest convention?
It is Oregon's oldest running science fi fantasy convention.
It's actually only the 14th anniversary. They just do them really frequently.
And do we have the dates for that yet?
Yes, we have the dates. We don't know which event is going to be which day.
Correct.
But it is running from the 8th to the 10th of November.
Oh, we're going to get that in the calendar.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's like kind of how I recently had my 11th annual 29th birthday.
Absolutely. You wouldn't want to be as old as Oricon.
No.
And just saying, folks, watch this space. We might have some other special events coming up.
Yeah. And speaking of special events, let's take this to the club. So, Mad Marquis, I understand that you are something of an icon in the Portland burlesque scene.
Well, I would certainly never call myself that because
I certainly would.
Certainly not in any way that I could be taped and held accountable for later. So I've been producing burlesque shows in Portland for about 9 years. Interestingly, Nathaniel was actually in the audience at the very first show I ever did. So that's adorable.
Like, that was the one at Guardian Games, wasn't it? Yeah.
So the first show we ever did was actually an all nerdy and pop culture burlesque show that we called Geeklesque.
Ah, yes.
So fucking good.
So good. Yeah.
Which was so wildly and ridiculously successful. We turned away something like 100 people at that event, or more. The line was down the block when we had to stop letting people in the venue.
And I remember that because I walked up to the venue and Nathaniel was maybe like 10th in line.
Yeah.
And I saw the line going around the block and he just kept winking at me. Xander, you're here finally. We saved you a spot. Wink, wink, aggressive wink. And I went, thanks, buddy. I'm glad I told you about the show.
Were you at that one too?
I don't think so. I've been to a Geeklesque before, but it was at a bigger theater at that point.
We were definitely never. Well, we did do another burlesque show at Guardian Games a year and a half or 2 years ago for their 10th anniversary.
That one I was at.
Yeah. I was there because
in
I had
location.
I had a good friend of mine, a goth DJ from Atlanta named Nathan. Now he changed his name to Nathaniel, but I was the first one. But he came and visited, and I took him around town. We were just randomly walking around, so we go into the Lovecraft, and there was some weird-ass music playing that night.
It's the Lovecraft.
And then we stumbled. I was like, hey, let's go to Guardian. It's around the corner. It's a good place. And we walk in. Everybody's like, oh, there's a stage? I'm like, what the fuck? And we just happened to walk in on that night.
Nice.
It was pretty cool.
Well, that
Angel was drunk as shit.
That is actually somewhat traditional.
There's a precedent for
Angel at burlesque shows. I don't want to call her out too much, but she has come to a lot of the Geeklesques. Guardian Games has sponsored all of them. And she has come to some of them, and not all of them has she been a non-drinker at.
I think one of my favorite memories of Geeklesque was my first introduction to Isaiah.
Yes.
When he played Xerxes.
Oh, yes.
300. There was a movie-themed Geeklesque.
That was, I actually think that show was might have been fantasy themed.
Fantasy
if I'm recalling correctly. I believe that was Geeklesque Sally's 4th.
I just remember the dwarf with the beard.
Yeah. Well, two beards, technically.
She had two beards, yes. But that was my first encounter with Isaiah, and he was in like 7-inch heels and was like 9 feet tall.
He starts at like 6.5 feet tall, so you put him in big shoes and it gets real ridiculous.
And I just, that is burned in my memory.
Yeah. I actually, not to not that reminiscing about my own shows isn't super self-aggrandizing and fun for me, but I actually kind of, I feel like maybe it might be wise for us to talk up burlesque for the people who don't know what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Outside of like, hey, that's some weird word I've heard before. And isn't there a Christina Aguilera movie? Let's,
Marquis, can you define burlesque for us?
No.
Next question.
That's only half a joke because it's actually pretty open-ended.
Does not violate the blue laws of the town you're in.
Which, of course, here in Portland, we don't have any of those.
In Oregon, we don't.
Yeah. Well, thank God, State Supreme Court, 1984.
Hell yeah.
When people talk about burlesque now, back in the day, it basically meant the same thing as the word vaudeville or cabaret. It was a meaningless sort of, it's a show. It didn't mean anything. These days, when people are talking about burlesque, they're primarily referring to strip-teasing, right? And so people taking off their clothes in a choreographed manner to one or more pieces of music, often with sort of a through line or a plot to why they're taking their clothes off, a little more of a narrative going on than just I'm getting naked for the amusement of whoever's handing me money. So that's what it means now. And so if you go to a burlesque show now, you should definitely expect striptease, but it tends to be in accordance with older blue laws in other parts of the country. So you tend to be looking at people who are stripping down, say here in Portland, where we don't have any laws about nudity. And so the strip clubs are all nude. A burlesque show, you would expect somebody to not strip down any more than probably pasties, aka nipple tassels, and like a G-string. And that would be as nude as they would get.
Usually I see them stripped down in a certain formula. There's a certain flow to it. Usually, like, you put in enough layers so that you can take off each layer one by one to the beat of the music. You take off each glove one by one. You take off each stocking one by one. And eventually, all you're left. And with the big reveal of your boobs, with pasties, usually some kind of creative tassels or something, and a merkin.
Well, and often the pasties are like, if it's a comedic act, the pasties might be the punchline of the joke, so to speak, because pasties can be incredibly decorative. So, you know, like if the act is about money, maybe their pasties are big gold dollar bills or whatever, dollar bill signs.
During your first Geeklesque show, you had the Mario and Luigi Princess Peach number.
Yes.
When Princess Peach was shaking her tatas, a bunch of gold coins flew out everywhere.
I still have
one of those.
In time to the cascading gold sound effect. That was a very tightly choreographed trio act. Yes.
Yeah, and then the pasties, I believe, were all mushrooms, if I'm not mistaken.
The Mario and Luigi were wearing mushroom pasties. Mario and Luigi were wearing, I believe, Invulnerability Star pasties.
Yeah.
Oh, the stars? Okay. And Princess Peach had one-up mushrooms.
Yeah. There was definitely a flag raising thing that happened, which was the final moment, pretty fucking phenomenal.
That act is actually fully from that show, in fact. So back in the day,
it's
available
YouTube.
On the Critical Hit Burlesque YouTube channel. Nice. So if you want to see that, not as fun as in person, but you know, it is there.
It's a good second way to watch.
So, Mark, what got you into it?
The honest answer is that it had to do with my partner at the time. She had wanted to – we were both theater people. I'm a theater person from doing all sorts of stuff.
No.
Not a theatrical person.
Represent.
An actual theater person, yeah. I'd been doing legit, as they say, theater for a long time.
Really?
And my now ex, she wanted to take some striptease lessons. I bought her – lessons at a local burlesque school, which there are a couple of in Portland. The Rosie School of Burlesque was the one she went to.
Oh,
there's also the All That Glitters Burlesque Academy here in Portland. And then we're both quite nerdy people, as I'm sure that's super hard to believe me. Had opinions about all the war games we just talked about. And so we were like, hey, let's do a nerdy burlesque show, because they'd happened in like New York and LA and a couple of other larger areas. And we're like, all of our burlesque friends are nerds. Let's do a nerd burlesque show. And there really is like a huge preponderance of nerds in the burlesque community. It's actually pretty fun.
Sure are.
And so we just did it. We approached the owner of Guardian Games at their old location. We're like, hey, we want to do a nerdy burlesque show. How do you feel about doing it here on one of your like adults only nights? Because that was already the point at which they had a bar in the game store, and they would occasionally have late nights that were only open to bar going patrons. And so we just worked out a date with her, and that ended up being pretty crazily successful. And I've been producing and hosting burlesque shows ever since.
And so I worked with you for a bit at the Lovecraft for Burlynomicon. What was your idea behind forming Burlynomicon? Because I wasn't there initially.
Sure. So the Burlynomicon literally just came out of, I'd heard about the Lovecraft Bar, went into it, Love the space because it is adorable.
Sure is.
Go stalk them on the internet to see what I'm talking about. It is an incredibly well-curated appearance, a bar in a very sort of gothy, Lovecraftian venue feel.
Tentacles coming out of the wall and all that.
Great stuff. And I made a meeting with the owner at the time, and I was like, hey, I want to do a kind of like, you know, Halloween-y year-round burlesque show here. Because like everybody, you know, everybody always has acts they only kind of do for the holidays they're appropriate for most of the time. So they may not have a chance to do them the rest of the time. And I was like, well, we'll do a show here. And then that'll be a chance for people to break out their Halloween acts year round so that we can all, you know, continue making money on them. And then it's just more, you're not just doing it in October for 6 weeks. And that was in 2011. So it was the bar had been open for about 6 months when we started there. And we've been there the second Tuesday of every month since. Although I still own the show, I am not myself hosting it anymore. It's being hosted now, starting this year, in fact, by a newer performer from the Bay Area. Not a newer performer, pardon me. She's been performing for a long time, but it's being hosted now by a lovely lady named Natasha Riot.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So what's also really funny about your show, so I used to do sound for it, and then I would DJ afterwards.
And a few other things randomly.
And that's what I was going to bring up, is I think at the third year, you kind of strong-armed me into doing my first act.
Yeah. So for our anniversary show every year, which is in September at that show, I would always do a slightly bigger show with a few extra performers, just a bigger, longer show for fun, just to celebrate the anniversary of the show. And Xander, I think, had been there for about 6 or 7 months at the point where I like was like, hey, you should do a striptease during that. Or was it longer than that? Am I misremembering?
No, because I did it for almost 4 years.
Yeah, but I feel like I strongly remember doing the first one only, and you'd only been there for maybe 9 months or less than a year, but maybe I'm wrong.
I think it had been 2 years at that point, because I was quite familiar with everybody there. And yeah. You had finally...
I was like, Xander, you should do a striptease during the show, because people always... It's always fun to make other people strip during the show who the audience isn't expecting. Yeah. Such as the regular sound guy who's always just hiding in the booth making noises happen and yelling bad jokes at me.
Yeah, because I did that frequently. So, yeah, so I eventually relented and said, okay.
It wasn't that hard. He gave it pretty quickly.
It wasn't that hard. Oh,
Xander.
Oh, no, that's half a joke. So I conceived of this notion to do a burlesque act to the film There Will Be Blood. in which I played Daniel Plainview. And
if you don't know what Xander looks like, Google Xander.
Yeah. It wasn't hard to go and be Daniel Plainview as the oil baron. And so basically the act was me going and drilling for oil to the song Roughneck by Johnny Cash as I slowly strip off my clothes because it's hot.
I'm pretty sure I saw this. Sounds very familiar.
At one point, I go and bring out a giant oil derrick made out of popsicle sticks. So when I stripped down to my underwear, I think the front side said blood for oil. And then when I bent over at one point, the back of my underwear said drill baby drill.
Wow.
And then I brought out the giant oil derrick and started thrusting into it. And I had one of those really giant, like 3 foot tall sparkler exploder things.
The confetti bombs.
Yeah, the confetti bombs that I... the very dramatic music by Johnny Greenwood as the oil derrick is exploding in the movie There Will Be Blood. As I was thrust into it, I eventually made that explode over the entire audience.
Wow.
So our city is teeming with burlesque groups these days, it seems. Like, I'm constantly getting advertisements from different Portland burlesque groups on Facebook, on via some email subscriptions. I see them all the time advertised at places like Bossa Nova and Crush and others.
Every stump town in town.
It's just, we have so much of it now. It's kind of a golden age.
Well, partially I think that that's threefold. If I were to sort of like try and pin down the reason why Portland is like that. One, you've got our lack of any fear of any police consequences, right? Because we don't have any blue laws. So nothing's going to negatively impact the venues or the performers, which is just not true in the rest of the country.
And for our audience, can you define what blue laws are?
Laws relating to sexual activity in public, right?
Nudity,
I don't know that
whatnot.
That's like actually what that means, but that's what I mean by it.
Yeah, yeah.
So in Oregon, the state Supreme Court back in 1984, which is why Portland has the most strip clubs per capita, if you weren't aware, basically said that freedom of expression and freedom of speech extends to things you do with your body as well as your voice.
So there are no laws in regarding...
My understanding is that you could, at a private venue, you can do literally everything. Like, you could have live pornography
in
Portland
Casa
if you
Diablo
wanted to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I used to go to an event called...
Total Submission
Total
Wrestling.
Total Domination.
Yeah.
Total Domination Wrestling.
I recall hooking you up with the directions to that event back in the day. In fact, after Wired ran that article about it, and you were like, what the fuck, man?
Oh, no. I was dating someone at the time who knew the people.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I remember you posted the Wired event and were like, where do I find this? And I was like, here's the event link.
I think that was someone else because I actually didn't even know about it until the person I was seeing invited me to
That's
go.
Funny. I wonder how many people I said to that. I never went, did. Oddly. That's
but
the funny
the Total
part.
Domination Wrestling was this event where these ladies would put on these character outfits and legitimately wrestle, and then the loser would get fucked by the winner. And
well,
on stage,
it's a lube wrestling fight over a strap on.
Yeah,
winner take all, as they
say. It was wonderful.
Yikes.
Yeah. Yeah, once again, kink.com owes Portland like huge IP payments.
Real quick, the point of order. Blue laws are a umbrella term for laws that have been in effect for a really long time that have to do with like things one is not allowed to do, such as like car dealerships not being open on Sundays, liquor stores not being open on Sundays, strip clubs, things like that. And again, citation needed. Everybody just go Google this eventually. But the last time I remember looking up what a blue law was, it had that term comes from just old time puritanical values about
sure and like for as a comparative thing, yeah. Like you think of like New York as sort of a city of sin, right? There's actually quite a few laws relating to how nude a woman can be in New York State and New York City, and amusingly, most of these laws are very sexist. For example, in New York City, it's only illegal for a man to be nude if he is, and I quote, visibly turgid.
Yeah, there is. I believe there are also laws here about nudity and that you cannot be doing anything "quote unquote" lewd in public.
Your intention cannot be to arouse yourself sexually.
There you go.
I believe is what it is,
or something like that. Or others.
It's entice or arouse because it's also to help prevent prostitution, right?
Yeah.
So, right.
Yeah. So partially that's why we have so many burlesque shows is that we're not going to like a bar that has a burlesque show at it is not going to lose their liquor license over it, which is the normal penalty in most of the rest of the country for violating these sort of vice laws. Is that if a venue has a liquor license, like Washington State to our north, I'm very familiar with their laws.
Yeah.
Washington. There are no all-nude strip clubs. For
Same
example.
Colorado.
They can have topless strip clubs, but they can't have all-nude strip clubs. And if
they can't serve liquor at them, I believe.
They cannot.
If liquor is being served, right?
It's sad.
Right. California is the same way. The all-nude strip clubs in California are all juice bars or whatever.
Right. So sad.
Whereas if it's a topless club, they can still serve liquor. And like in Washington, there's like rules about like how much fabric has to cover certain areas. Like in Washington, they have to have 1 inch of fabric covering the entire cleft of their buttocks, right? So like a thong has to be a certain width to be legal at a strip club.
Right.
So
or
what,
any place that's
what
serving alcohol.
Poor bastard has to go and be the inspector that has to go with the measuring
the vice
tape.
Caps.
Vice caps.
Yeah. That's probably why they keep those laws.
The
in
funny
place.
Thing I like to
I'm
make
sorry, I have to bust this place. I have to check the width of the G string.
My favorite thing is thinking about like in Kansas, I believe it is, there's rules about like under boob and like under buttocks exposure, right? Which leads to, you know, burlesque sort of plays with all of these laws, even though they're not necessarily super heavily enforced anywhere in the country anymore. So like a lot of burlesque costumes incorporate fringe that covers the under curve of the buttocks, because at one point that was a costume choice somebody had to make to legally do a dance in Kansas or Missouri or wherever.
Wow.
Fun fact, that's why flapper dresses originally had fringe.
Well, and pasties are also that, because nipple coverage is a thing in some of the laws. And all of these things are basically just, especially in Oregon where the laws don't apply to us, all of our costume choices are sort of playing with these laws that don't matter to us anymore.
And I think that it's kind of cool what all of these performers have taken. Mm-hmm. They've taken these old antiquated, overly restrictive laws that were, you know, quite sexist in nature, but and turned it into a performance art, and quite frequently get extremely creative.
Oh, absolutely.
With the themes and the variety of their shows.
You were talking about what leads to Portland being this renaissance place for burlesque shows. The other thing I'm going to point out is just the Portland economy. Everybody in this town needs a side hustle. And most of the people I know who are active in burlesque, it's like their second job, and it's the second job they enjoy doing.
Sure. There's definitely, there's that whole, that German word about like how there's your bread job and then like what you do to feed your soul. And I don't remember, I don't speak German, but I remember the Germans naturally have big, giant words that explain all these things.
Gehandehugen.
Whatever, right? Farfignugen.
We just lost Germany.
Shit.
So, yeah, there's definitely some of that. Like, I only produce shows now and do private events. But, yeah, there's definitely some of that. But, conversely, the punch-up of rent in Portland is also part of why shows cost more than they used to. You know, the first show I ever did was, almost 10 years ago was $6 or $7 to get into.
Wow.
And I'm not going to charge people less than $15 to come see a live striptease performance now.
Yeah.
Because I mean, inflation's a thing. Like, that's, you've got to pay people what they're deserving. I very much am like, nothing should cost less than going to see a movie, like a new movie.
Right.
That's sort of my logic totally for live entertainment. Yeah. I would never charge less than like $13 that a movie costs.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. People got to get paid, and people got to get paid for what they deserve.
So I do have a question then on the costs that you intake per ticket. Does that get split?
Depends on the show model, right? Yeah. Like, so I'm very open with my performers about what the math underpinning this thing. So I don't mind talking about this at all. So for Berlinomicon, the way that show was structured, we took all of the sales at the door came to me, and then it was just after the small expenses of paying, say, my stage staff and my door person who would collect money, it would just be a five-way split between me and the four performers of all the remaining money. Other shows have different structures. So like the last Geek Lesk I did, which was a Star Wars show, Geek Lesk from a Galaxy Far, Far Away, which we did on the 40th anniversary of Star Wars, I paid out a flat rate to all the performers of either $100 or $175, depending on if they were doing one or two acts in the show.
Is that the one at the Paris?
That was at the Paris Theater.
I saw that one. Yes.
And then in that case, I guaranteed them that pay regardless of how we did. So I was floating all the risk, me and my co-producer, Rick. And so we collected any profit above and beyond the costs of paying for the venue, paying for the sound engineer, paying the staff, and paying the performers. So in that case, in theory, if I'd sold, we were pretty close to sold out on Saturday and not so close on Friday of the two nights of the show. If we had sold out both nights, I would have made more money. The performers would have made the same amount of money, for example.
Well, we're running long on time here, Mark, but do you have any shows coming up you can talk about?
Sure. Currently, I have a show every single Saturday night at the Jack London Review, which is a jazz club underneath the Rialto Pool Hall downtown.
Hell yeah. That place is classy.
You follow the wooden path through the Rialto Pool Hall to the stairs downstairs at the back of the room, and then you're down in the jazz club. It's jazz night on Saturday nights there. There's a live band performing. We go on right after the last band finishes, roughly at about 11:30, and that's almost every single Saturday night. It's Saturday night from now until we're being bumped for Jazz Fest in March, for example. Occasionally we get bumped, but it's mostly every Saturday night.
Okay. And is it the Geeklesque group?
It is a variety of performers. It's every week, so it's a rotating cast of people, both local and traveling. I have people in from all over the country.
Oh, nice.
This weekend, I have all of the performers happen to be local, and that is often the case. But next weekend, for example, I have a performer coming down from Seattle. And that's pretty common, or from elsewhere in the country. And yeah, that show starts after 11:30 reliably every Saturday night. After the bands get done, you can go see the bands and stay for our show for free, or just show up for the burlesque after 11 o'clock and hang out with us and watch some classic striptease, which we sneak the nerdy in pretty frequently, though, because it's me. And I know that the crowd in Portland likes nerdy stuff no matter what they're there for.
And do your shows do the send the basket around to tip the performers?
Correct. So at my shows, for example, because I'm a pinko commie, we pool our tips together and split them evenly amongst the performers.
Nice.
So I send a staff member around for tips at the break in the middle of the show and at the end of the show, and just pool those tips. And then the four performers at that show, for example, take that money.
Excellent.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
2019's looking pretty awesome.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Hope so.
Hope so, yeah. And I think we've got an email. Ready?
Right. We did get an email. So we, whenever we get mail, we like to go and make sure that we read it, or at least part of it, especially because sometimes they're quite long. But so from our last episode about ghost bikes, we had this guy named David Matthews from Georgia send us an email.
Good old Georgia.
And he is a maker of ghost bikes for people. Now, his story is interesting. So back in 2011, he got into a pretty bad bicycle accident. He had a bunch of stitches, lost a tooth, many weeks of recovery. And then he was telling me that about 15 months later, someone had been hit by a car about a little over a mile from his house. And his bike crew was worried it might have been someone from their crew, but it wasn't. But it was so close to his house. And then he realized that this guy was basically the same age that he was. He also had two daughters who were never going to have a father again. And it really struck him.
You're killing me.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, this is serious stuff, you know. And so he decided to go and take the bike that he had gotten in a wreck with. And he went and decided to take that wrecked bike and to make it into a ghost bike for this guy that had died near his house. And ever since then, he has made over 65 ghost bikes in 5 different states. And that's just what he does. He takes donations, but he does it, you know, kind of all on his own time for anybody that needs one. I thought that was a really cool email that we got from him. Mm-hmm. So
thanks for doing the good work, man. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you. David Matthews. It was David Matthews.
David Matthews.
Just to go and get a little bit of what he has to say here. I got involved in doing ghost bikes because I cannot believe that our society just turns our heads and looks the other way most of the time on this kind of preventable tragedy. And then he kind of goes on to say, biking in Georgia, for the most part, and the Southeast has decent roads. Drivers are learning about the 3-foot laws and hands-free laws and how to use the road with other modes of transportation. It's a slow process, I'm afraid. The power and ego that comes from being behind the wheel of an automobile without much penalty when doing it wrong hasn't fared well for humanity. When a guilty driver gets maybe just a few years in jail, that's a slap in the face to their fallen friends and family. So this guy is Bike Friendly ATL, or Bike Friendly Atlanta. He wants to give a shout out to his wife and his daughters for their support because they were with him when he got in that bad accident. The 6 a.m. at the Arches Cycling Group in Decatur, Georgia.
Decatur.
Yeah.
Decatur. I lived there for a while.
Did you really?
Yeah.
It's not pronounced Decatur.
Decatur.
It's Decatur. Yeah.
Decatur.
Decatur.
Now that we've insulted this nice man who wrote us a letter's accent.
Yeah.
We apologize for our guest.
And our hosts.
and everybody.
I apologize for our hosts.
Well, thanks for writing us, David.
So one last quick thing. Yeah. Bikefriendlyatl.org, if you want to go and donate to him making ghost bikes for people that need them, who have had friends that have fallen on the road, or to Bike Friendly ATL Incorporated on Facebook, bikefriendlyatl@gmail.com, if you want to get in contact with Dave. And he wrote to us and said he is making ghost bikes for people that need them. So if you need one or you want to donate to that cause, you can reach out to him there. And we'll have links in our podcast notes.
We will definitely have links.
Awesome. Thank you so much for writing, Dave.
Thank you. And glad to see you survived that. You know, and that you're not one of those bikes on the side of the street.
Yeah, yep. For sure.
So thanks for joining us again, Mark. It's been good to have you here.
Hey, it just occurred to me that, you know, for the listeners who can make it out to the show, tell my door person that you heard about the show on this podcast and we'll let you in for, I don't know, half price.
Ooh.
Nice.
Hey. If you heard about Mad Marquis's show underneath the Rialto.
Yep, the Jack London Burly Q Review every Saturday night.
If you heard about it on Bikers, Dice, and Bars, folks.
Yeah, let him know and then you let us know.
It's so cute you think that I know what goes on while I'm busy on stage.
I can tell you for a fact, he does not.
Well, let's go ahead and close this out. Once again, you've been listening to Bikers, Dice, and Bars, recorded here in Portland, Oregon. Join us on Discord. Send us an email. We'll give you a shout out and read some of it out loud on the air. And also leave us an iTunes review if you like what you hear.
Watch the good doctor flex his muscles on our Instagram account.
Oh, yeah. Our the best looking podcast host that we don't have video of.
Oh,
okay. Well, I have video of him.
Oh, well, really? It's out there.
I at least have pictures we could dig up. We should add some pictures to the show notes of the striptease he was describing. Oh,
Jesus
we can find
Christ.
Those.
If you send me those
That's
links.
Behind a paywall.
Patreon exclusive.
Well, that's the fun thing about striptease pictures is we could show them the first couple pictures from the striptease and then hide the climax behind the paywall.
Yeah.
If you send me those links before this show goes live this weekend, then they'll be in the show notes.
I
can't guarantee anything.
I'm also definitely going to send you the ticket link, the venue link, and the Facebook event page for the show.
Excellent. Anyway, once again, you've been listening to us. I am NPC.
I am just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
Poppy Beaujolais.
And joining us as our special guest,
the Mad Marquis.
And as usual, we want to remind you,
rubber side down.
Always tip your bartender.
May your dice always roll criticals.
And please always drink responsibly.
Hey, and tip performers, too.
Yes, they deserve it.
They sure do.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your car. But Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Yep.